Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another episode of the Footmarks podcast on Combox, where the game lives on. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at Def Mango on Twitter, and with me is Jared Kimber, who you can find literally everywhere. And the topic for this episode of the Footmarks podcast is, or the title, in fact, is Farewell to the People's Champ, because we will be talking about Usman Khawaja, who has announced his retirement. The SCG test, the ongoing SCG test, in fact, will be his last. This is being recorded after day one, so he hasn't batted yet. But Jared, at 39 years of age, Usman Khawaja has called time on his international career. And, he started off his playing career or test career versus England at the SCG in an Ashes series, which was lost. And over here, he'll bow out when it has been won. Look, his form has dropped over the last 2 years, and this seemed to be, writing on the wall in many ways. I would like to think that he's, timed this retirement call quite perfectly.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I think there was always a chance he was going to retire at the end of the India series last year or after the World Test Championship. So I think Australia said, we need you, especially because they didn't have another opener, right? And so I think there was an element of that. So I don't know if it was timed perfectly or not. It was just, he's a player who, I heard him talking about how he's played 88 tests, but he's really had, so many different careers all the way through. Mm. I think he probably hung around as long as he was needed and he felt like he could make runs. And maybe he's got to a point where he's like, maybe this is it. At that age, like you kind of, you start to make decisions and maybe he's just decided to move on.
Yep. And I mean, there's no doubt about the fact that the runs had dried up, but it's still a very distinguished career. He's going to go down as one of the most important Australian cricketers of all time. And there's a lot of off-field stuff in this as well. But I actually want to address the on-field stuff before we get to that. Now, after 87 test matches before the SCG test, Usman Khawaja had scored north of 6,200 runs. He had a batting average of 43 plus. And what's more important, perhaps, is his contribution as an opener for Australia. That was after his previous comeback. If we're counting this as a comeback, I'm not sure. But, when he scored twin tons at the SCG and then went on to just, go a bit crazy, honestly. He was the best opening batter in the world for a couple of years. His average as an opener in test cricket is 48 plus. And I find it really remarkable that he managed that sort of average in the pace playing pandemic, in the wobble seam era, where a lot of batters, the best in the business, they had started to struggle, but Uzi found a way, and that's kind of been his entire career. He's always found a way. He's punished the poor balls, very strong on the pull and the sweep, and sure, square of the wicket on the offside as well. But he's been someone who has constantly sort of dug himself out of a hole, upskilled, and been a better version.
Yeah, I think he was, for considering the hype around him when he started, he was probably a bit of a late starter compared to guys like Michael Clarke and Phil Hughes and maybe even Cameron Green. I think he was a little bit older. And he wasn't the most polished player, but he obviously always had the very basic skills that he had time. I remember talking to, it might have been Rod Marsh, when he made his debut, and I sort of said, what do you think? And he said, he's got time. Like he's got, something that not everyone has. So I think there was always that element to him, but it wasn't always the most perfect game, right? Like, there were flaws within his batting. And I think there were times when he couldn't get the most out of himself. And then there were times when it looked like you couldn't get him out. He kind of just fluctuated between those two, right? And coming back at that point, when he came back, I have to go back and check my running, but I don't remember thinking this makes a lot of sense because he'd been a middle order player really at that point and looked more suited to the middle order. Hmm. And suddenly he came back and, as you said, becomes the best opener in the world. And maybe it could have been his spot all along, but I just think he changed his game by that point and it really suited batting in that position.
I mean, if we look at, that little period where Travis Head gets COVID, Khawaja somehow makes his way into the starting 11. And it's funny how something similar has happened in this ongoing Ashes series where had Stephen Smith not gotten symptoms of vertigo, maybe that was the end of Khawaja's career, right? So he's had these weird opportunities throughout his career when he's basically cashed in and grabbed those opportunities with both hands. I feel that, he has been a problem solver in the sense that, you know, if he was one-dimensional at the start, he kind of upskills and becomes a really, really good slip fielder. Yeah. He becomes a leader, someone who's a very vocal person in that dressing room, someone who people feel like they can open up to. He's basically played that role. And also, he's been a versatile batter. You've got to give him that because, you know, like you said, he was more suited or looked more suited to the, you know, middle order batting position or some sort of role within the middle order.
Well, but I think he starts at number three, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And then... it looks like he's going to be a number 4-5 type batter and then comes back as an opener. Like he's kind of batted everywhere they've asked him to.
Yeah, and he's been very disciplined because, you know, when he gets that role of opening the batting for Australia, from that point on, SCG test in that Ashes series, that another one that English fans wouldn't like to remember, from that point on till about, you know, mid-2023 or something like that, maybe the end of that Sri Lanka series in which he scores that double ton, Khwaja was averaging 60 with the bat. I mean, I remember at one point when we were talking about, you know, the best openers in contemporary test cricket, Usman Khwaja and Rohit Sharma were two names which were up there for quite a long time. And what he achieves is incredible because averaging 48 plus as an opening batter overall in a period where run scoring has gotten harder and fast bowlers are taking wickets for fun, I feel like that might be the most important part of his cricketing legacy.
Yeah, I suppose as far as, you know, playing the game is concerned, I think that's the difference between him being a middling player, right? And him being remembered as a very good player. Possibly because he's had a couple of down years on the back end of it. It's been sullied a little bit. But yeah, that peak, anyone who's paying attention knows just how good that peak was. No one was making runs, right? And Khwaja, you just couldn't get him out for a long period of time. He also had the ability of being very good against spin, right? So it wasn't like, you know, so if you look at Dean Elgar or Karunaratne, who were two other guys who did well opening the batting in a similar period, Karunaratne didn't really translate outside of Asia as much. And Dean Elgar didn't really handle the spin as much, right? Actually, Dean Elgar's record is also bizarre, but... You know, in Khwaja's case, we, you know, and maybe a little bit like, as you said, Rohit Sharma, even though they're very different cricketers, I kind of feel like once they found that position, it kind of suited where they were at that time in their life. I don't think that necessarily means that Khwaja should have been an opener when he was 25, right? I do think there is an element of when he got there, it was the right time for him. But
yeah,
I think that's his legacy, is that couple of years period. Because outside of that, he had some good moments, but he also had, I mean, he was dropped several times. He was terrible in first-class cricket. We've done a whole podcast on this, right? Yeah. He was absolutely terrible in first-class cricket for a long period of time as well. So, you know, there's been lots of different ups and downs when it comes to his career. And the real up is that period where no one's scoring runs and he's just lighting people up.
Yeah, I mean, he has made about 7 to 8 comebacks into the Australian test team. And, you know, he was dropped quite frequently, sometimes fairly, perhaps sometimes unfairly. He would definitely argue that there were a few of those times. But you mentioned how, you know, it's been a very fascinating career where at times he's looked like a all-time great, especially that 2-year period in between where he's scoring runs for fun, opening the batting. But then there have been moments in his career where he's struggled as a first-class batter as well. So it's what we call at Good Areas a cluster batter or a spree batter. And we've had this discussion plenty of times where, you know, a cluster batter or spree batter is a batter who has very high peaks and very low troughs. So it's been kind of up and down, up and down, up and down. And maybe you can throw in the fact that he's been versatile in the sense that he's batted in different positions. But the theme is very, very consistent and it translates to first class level. And it is a bit of an enigma, right? Because now he's 39 years of age. It's really hard for him to bounce back from this ongoing trough because, you know, perhaps that MCG, oh wait, what was that? The Adelaide test. That was one of the better test matches that he's played in recent times. Other than that, I mean, he's been a bit of a walking wicket recently, but it is quite fascinating how his career has just gone up and down, up and down. And there's no great way to explain that either.
No, you know, I don't know. This is one of those things that cricket media is still not quite there. You know, he talks quite a bit about politics and people have talked to him about batting a little bit. But it would be interesting to know why he thinks that happened. Because he said before he was quite harshly treated. But you look at his record, there were some other times when I think Australia probably should have dropped him and they didn't drop him as well. Like not this most recent one. I think this most recent one makes sense that they kept him around. But there were some other times where I think they, you know, it probably made sense to get rid of him. And, you know, in 2019, he was probably dropped a little bit too early. And I think that's the one that he's always talked about. But then he went back and made 0 runs. So either you say he was dropped too early And that broke his confidence. But he wasn't like he was a junior player then. He was like in his early to mid 30s, right? There doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason. He just goes through usually a 2 or 3 year period where you don't get him out, and then a 2 or 3 year period where everyone gets him out, and then it stops, and then it just switches over again. And as you said, it's, you know, if you look at guys like Johnny Bairstow or Gary Balance, right? Similar kinds of players that have very high ends and very low lows when they're struggling. They usually went back to first class cricket and just cleaned up. Right? And Khawaja didn't. You know, there wasn't, you know, so it's a very different situation, I think, from what we normally see.
Yeah, and I mean, if you don't look at this most recent peak, there was another one that came in test cricket in around like that 2014-15 period. He scored 4 tons across 5 test matches, and that's where he really stamps his authority. And I just feel that, you know, and this might be completely wrong because it's an assumption on my part, but that last opportunity or that crazy comeback game that he has when Travis Head is out with COVID and he scores twin tons and he brings out the LeBron celebration and, I mean, another fun one, I sensed that there has been some sort of clarity of mind moment. You know, he's had an epiphany of sorts where he is now playing freely. He does not have any of that baggage that he was initially carrying. Perhaps he had grown as a person, but it seemed to me that he was treating every test match as his last and he really didn't want to give up that particular opportunity. And that brings about his best period in international cricket. So I feel like that is a great arc on its own.
Yeah. And I think that happens quite a lot. I think there's a situation where you think, oh, it's done. And so the pressure goes off you. He's also at that stage, like he seems to be a player who had a slightly later peak anyway. You know, maybe he was just reaching his peak and everything else. But like he gets dropped in 2019. As we said, you could make the argument it was slightly too early. But in 2019, across like 14 matches, he averages 28, right? And in 2020, he averages 36. That's 20 matches where he's averaging barely over 30 in first-class cricket without playing a lot. That's only 5 or 6 test matches, I think, in that time. And so when he comes back, he has a big year in 2021 where he averages over 50 in first-class cricket. So when he came back, he was back in that mode again, right? And he makes a bunch of runs. And it's, you know, I think maybe you're right. Maybe it could be pressure. It could be understanding his game. I just think he's probably someone who thinks a lot about his game. And that has been absolutely helped him at times, and it's probably absolutely held him back at times.
Yeah. Fun fact for you, you've probably come across this already, but Usman Khawaja has scored the 7th most runs in test cricket after turning 35. Of course, there are 6 great players ahead of him over there as well. But in that most recent comeback, right, from 2021 onwards, he scored runs in bulk all across the globe. And that was all when he was fairly, you know, aged. And, you know, top scoring in an away Ashes series and in an away Border Gavaskar trophy. I think that really counts for something. I feel like those two moments are where he kind of solidifies his legend, perhaps, because you remember we were covering the Ashes in 2023 and all the talk was around how Khawaja will probably fail over here. And there he goes, first test match, he scores a ton, he top scores in that series. That for me might have been that defining moment where people finally acknowledged that this guy probably means business.
Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. Yeah, I think he had to do that, right? Like, I think there was an element where he kind of had to tick that final box of being, you know, rather than a player who was quite handy, that being like a legit player because of his record and everything else that had gone before that. I mean, realistically, now with everything we know, he'd already conquered England before he got to England because he'd already played the same conditions, maybe harder conditions in Australia at that point, right? So looking back on it, like, we were probably thinking about it incorrectly. But yeah, I think he had to do that for himself. And it was a fantastic series. It was also kind of funny that like the guy that was the most steady player in that series is the least Basbolian of everyone.
Yeah. And, you know, he has been that sort of player where once he is set, he looks almost impossible to get out. You mentioned in your piece about a week or week and a half ago that he's been a bit of a flat track bully in the sense that you just cannot get him out on flat tracks. And that's why he scored a lot of runs or has averaged really high as a batter in test matches which have been drawn. But even in test matches where, you know, Australia has won, he's averaged north of 50. So there is an element of... If Khawaja does well, we're set up really, really nicely. And he knew his limitations. He had a few, right? He wasn't an absolute free-flowing bat. At times, he looked awkward, but he wouldn't spare you on the pull. If it's hip-high friendly stuff, he's going to bludgeon it away. And versus spin, it's such a great story. I mean, look, this is the guy who couldn't buy a run on that tour to Sri Lanka where he got dropped as well. And, you know, it looked like, oh, an Asian player, even if he's Australian, he's struggling in Sri Lanka. That means that this guy isn't like, you know, all conditions based. He isn't good for every sort of venue and he might be only good in Australia. After that series, he comes and ends up with a batting average of 61.8 in test matches in Asia. And he top scores in that Border Gavaskar trophy in India. He's the top scorer across both teams, mind you, not just for Australia. I mean, that is one way of getting a massive monkey off your back because, you know, I was convinced that he cannot play spin. And JL is apparently the guy who kind of motivated him that I've seen you do well versus spin in first class cricket. So you can do this. And he credited JL for that as well.
I actually remember them... you know, talking to a bunch of people around the Australian team who were like, we don't understand it. Like, we know he can play spin and there's something not working here. If you look at him, he's actually, you know, and he's actually in a really interesting position because obviously there's some Asian influence within his cricket, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, the sort of players he looks up to and also, you know, family and friends, right? Like, I grew up with a lot of Asian cricketers, obviously in Melbourne, and, you know, they played spin in a different way than the, you know, the more Western kids did a lot of the time. But he is actually a combination of the modern way of playing spin, which is he can still use his feet. He doesn't come down the wicket like Pujara or Michael Clarke, but he'd probably be one of the last guys in the world who really uses his feet correctly, right? Like, not often, but when he comes down, he usually comes down to play a big shot and he hits pretty dead straight. Remember England in the 2023 Ashes putting the straight on fielder for him, right? You know, the straight hit fielder. So he plays that, but he also sweeps, which is a more Western thing, right? And you know, maybe a more Pakistani thing, but it's, you know, it's not, it's certainly, you know, not as much, you know, these days it's probably more seen as what an English South African sort of method. So he kind of has the best of both worlds, I think, in the way he plays his spin. So yeah, I think it made sense that he eventually made his runs in there. But it also must have been a lot of pressure on, like, there haven't been a lot of Asian cricketers who played for Australia before. Australia has traditionally struggled in Asia. They've got an Asian player. They must have been like, so you're going to make runs in Asia for us? And it didn't quite happen straight away. So good on him for working it out. And yeah, I think going back, it's weird that it, you know, he does have a sort of, I don't know if you, who you, it's kind of like a pared down version of Yunus Khan. He doesn't have Yunus Khan's, all of Yunus Khan's tricks, but there's an element of, sometimes he's quite ugly against spin, but not in a uncomfortable way, but in a like, oh no, this is the bad ball. So I'm going to absolutely hammer the crap out of it way. He plays it very much under his eyes in that sort of back footy way that Yunus Khan can. But then, as I said before, he can use his feet and he can sweep. Again, you know, parallels to Yunus Khan there. It'd be interesting to know if he did that. I think Nathan Lyon put a video out recently saying that no one talks about Yunus Khan and he was an absolute genius. I know the Australians really rated him as a player of spin almost higher than anyone else.
I think he might have, didn't
he work briefly with the Australian team after he retired?
I'm not quite sure about that, but if you ask me from what cricket
I've
watched...
He was consulting. I can promise you he consulted with the Australian team. I don't know how much actual work he did.
I've been watching cricket quite avidly for over two decades, and I'm yet to see a better player of the sweep shot than Yunus Khan. And in fact, Chiteshwar Pujara was on one of those Crick Info short videos, and you know, they were asking him which players does he think were better than him playing spin, and they were throwing names at him. And Yunus Khan is the only name where Pujara was like, no, he definitely played spin better than me. Yeah. And Khawaja was almost stubborn in the way he played spin, I feel, because he would put the bad balls away, but he was just such of a, you know, leech maybe, for the lack of a better word, because he would stick around over there.
Yeah, it's that soft bat kind of hitting the ball under your eyes way of playing. He was very, very, and I suppose this is one of the reasons I also compare him to Yunus Khan. He's very, very comfortable playing on the back foot against balls that other players wouldn't be comfortable playing on the back foot against, right?
Yeah.
Partly because he knew he was playing it directly under his eyes and he knew he had soft hands. So he wasn't as worried as perhaps some of the other players have been. But I think that he certainly has to go down as one of Australia's best players of spin. And I don't think you would have had him on that trajectory early on.
No, I, for one, can confirm over here on this podcast that when that Sri Lankan tour happened in Australia, I think lost 3-0 or something, right? It was bad. And Khwaja must not have scored 100 runs cumulatively. I would have to go and check, but he flopped pretty hard. I thought to myself that, oh, this is it. This is the end of his career, because they would have thought that he's going to be good in Asia, and he's the exact opposite. For him to then go on and average 61.8 across test matches in Asia, or played in Asia, and then he's only one of two Australians who've scored a test 100 in India, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka. The other one is Alan Border. I feel like that also is a pretty big, you know, sort of milestone that he can kind of check that box off. And when people will look back to his career, this will be one of the main things they'll talk about.
No, definitely. It's one of the things that, so he was briefly, because he was in such good form. Like, I remember Cheyenne, when we were writing the book, you know, suddenly sent me a message, go, do we have to seriously look at Usman Khawaja? And he wasn't on our list originally, but that part of the reason was his average was so low. And he eventually got that back up. But there was an element of, like, do we have to rethink about the, you know, where he fits in? And one of the things that we were both looking at was the fact that he can play the moving ball. He can play off the back foot against quicks, and he can play spinning ball specifically in Asia. That's actually a fairly limited skill set if you look at the history of Test cricket. And as I said before, it probably is a combination of, you know, I forgot to mention this one before. He's from Sydney, and when he grew up, the pitches were still spinning there.
Yeah.
Right? Especially the club's pitches, right? You know, if you look at a lot of Australia's better players of spin, they came from Sydney at that point. He does have the Asian influence as well. But then, because he's from Australia, he also has the ability to play off the back foot, right? If anything, he's limited at sometimes off the front foot against the quicks, you know, which, again, can be a bit of an Australian trait for some players. But having that skill set, there aren't that many people in the world who have the ability to play the lateral moving ball in a period like the wobble ball like he was, and also be that good against spin. Like, it's a really high ceiling, even if we know that over his entire career, there are still many other caveats and, you know, disclaimers we could put in. And, you know, one of the reasons we didn't put him in the list, even when he was playing really well, was we felt like it was really unfair that a guy couldn't make any runs in first-class cricket.
Yeah.
Right? Like, during his peak years, was suddenly, you know, that, like, what would he have averaged in Test cricket if Australia had never dropped him? It's probably less than 40, right? And if that's the case, he's not on our list. So that was one of the reasons that we had to do that. But yeah, his actual individual skills are really, really interesting. And that goes back to what we were saying before of, I thought Australia were thinking, we don't need him in the top three anymore, but if we can bat him at number five, and this is kind of, Travis Head was obviously exploding at this point as well, but no one knew Travis Head was going to be this Travis Head.
Yeah.
You know, if I was like, he makes sense at number five, and then he ends up as an opener. Like, it really is a remarkably weird little period for him.
I mean, when it comes to you considering him for your book, I know that an average of 43 in Test cricket isn't considered, like, great. But if we look at the era and what he did in that particular era as an opener, then I can see how you guys came to consider him. But it's the cluster.
But he also batted in a great era, to be fair, and didn't make any runs. So it is, that's what I mean. He's, you know, there's no way he could be in our final 50. He certainly couldn't be in the top 40. But at the same time, there are individual things. There's almost a Graham Gooch quality to him as well. That is, Graham Gooch probably averages as low as he does because he never got dropped, right?
Yeah.
Or he didn't really get dropped, like, didn't disappear. Obviously, there were other issues with Graham Gooch, but he plays for a very, very long time. And both of them are very smart batting guys, right? Like, I can see how, if Khawaja wanted to be, and I don't think he will, but if he wanted to be, I think he'd be a really good batting coach because he really thinks about batting. And Graham Gooch is another one. Well, you said before they are two of the highest scorers of all time over the age. We didn't say Graham Gooch, but you meant Graham Gooch was one of them, scoring over the age of 35. And, you know, to go back to the book and talking about what Kumar Sangakkara's father said, he said, those are the guys who really, really understand batting, right? Those are the great technicians. And I think it just took longer for Khawaja and for Gooch to work out how to make that work at test level. And I think that's the big difference, that they both had issues with that. Because if you look at them as senior players, they're great. It just happens to be that they also played a lot when they were not great.
I'm down very, very curious to see who scored those most runs over the age of 35. My guesses would be, you know, Gooch, Misbah, Yunus, maybe Sachin Dravid, Mike Hussey. Are those the six guys?
I thought Kumar might have been in that list as well. Was he
let's
not?
Check. Most runs scored in tests after the age of 35. Anyway, I'm struggling at this because I also have to hold this conversation. Why don't you look it up, Jared, and let I'll me know what the names
you
are.
You ask me the next question. I can do this in my sleep.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's a lot more that we could talk about his cricketing ability, but there's one thing in particular that caught my eye in your piece, and I've always thought or found this to be quite interesting, is that he is predominantly a back foot player. And I feel like that's the Australian side of Usman Khawaja, because yes, he'll have some skills which you'd expect an Asian or a batter with an Asian background to have, but there's a lot of Australian in him. And I feel like all of that back foot play is or lays testament to that.
Yeah, and I think if you look at, you know, if you look at Australia, it does allow, especially the players from Sydney and maybe the players from Western Australia that grow up in slightly different conditions than everyone else. Sometimes we do get these sort of outliers that come out of there. So Damian Martin goes on to be a great player of spin, right? Mm. And I think in South Australia, in New South Wales, you have a similar thing of there's so much spin and a lot of those wickets are so dusty at times that, you know, once you get to the international level, you've actually played a lot more spin, you know, I was a spinner in Melbourne and our wickets were pretty bouncy, pretty green, right? Mm. Yeah. If you got a ball to seam around, you would be able to spin it on the same surface, but why would you need your spinner in that, right? Like, I played on lots of wickets like that and hard flat wickets. New South Wales was always a little bit different. So I do think he is a combination of all those things. And I think that's when you look at, I'm just going to pick a bunch of random names out of my head, but someone like Heinrich Klaassen, right? Or Joe Root. Quite often, those sorts of players, there's a reason why they come through the system and it helps. And I think, as I said before, the combination of being a back foot player, but also being very comfortable against spin and being good against the lateral moving ball is quite a rare thing. But it probably makes sense for Usman Khawaja because he plays the ball under his eye. He does like to go on the back foot. And then he has multiple options against the spinning ball. So it makes sense, but it's a rarer package than we normally see.
Right. Do you have the names in front of you?
Oh, top I do. Six sorry, yeah.
Run scorers.
We had. Oh no, we missed one actually. Okay. Between us, it was Gooch is the number one, so he had 45 runs after 35, which is ridiculous. Then you got Misbah, Sachin, Boycott was the one we missed.
Okay.
Yunus Khan, Rahul Dravid, and then who did I say? I said Kumar. He's a little bit further down the list, Kumar, but Kumar. Maybe I'm getting confused because Kumar makes 2,500 runs after turning 35, but an average of 60.
Okay.
So it might have been the average I was remembering with Kumar, not the amount of games.
What about Mike Hussey? Because I took his name. I'd imagine him to be there.
I think he's a little bit lower. Sorry. Where was Mike Hussey on this? So you got Alex Stewart, Chandrapal. Hussey is down just under Kumar Sangakkara and Alan Border. So Alan Border's another high. There's actually quite a lot of guys sort of around that 2,500 run mark. And then the sort of 3,000 and above, that's where it starts to thin out a little bit more.
Yeah. Well, at least we got like 5 out of 6. But anyway, there's more to discuss with respect to Usman Khawaja, especially all of the off-field stuff, which I feel like it deserves a proper, you know, mention and some airtime. But before that, we will be taking a short break. You guys are watching the Footmarks podcast on Combox with Behram and Jared. And go nowhere because we will be back in like half a minute.
Ross Taylor couldn't see at night or when the clouds were in. Eventually, he had to see an eye specialist who would fix his eyesight. In the 2 years before the change, he still averaged more than 50 in international cricket. The top level of batting talent can basically see in the dark. That is who we are talking about in our new book, The Art of Batting. Head over and order your copy today.
Welcome back to the Footmarks podcast. You are with Behram and Jared, and we are going over the career or test career of Usman Khawaja, who is going to be retiring at the end of the SCG test in the Ashes. But, you know, his white ball career also deserves a bit of a mention, Jared. In between, he was pretty damn good at ODIs. I know he plays like 9 T20Is for Australia as well, including a T20 World Cup. But in ODI cricket, my mind goes back to that series in India where he just goes berserk, right? He wins Australia that ODI series in India. And Australia haven't done that, quite frequently in the last 2-3 decades, I would assume. So, I mean, what's your take on Usman Khawaja, the white ball cricketer? Clearly, it wasn't his strongest suit. But for a minute in between, he kind of made things work.
He had a couple of micro moments. I remember there was a, I can't remember what year it was, but I was in Australia and the Big Bash was on and he felt like he was making runs every game. And he had these micro bursts in white ball cricket where I think he worked out a method that would work for a little while and then the bowlers would kind of catch up and sort of shut him down a little bit. His big problem in white ball cricket was he just wasn't a fast enough scorer and he didn't have enough boundary options. You know, being a square of the wicket player really limits you in modern white ball cricket, right? Like in the old days, it didn't. Like if you had two boundary areas, that was fine. Now you really need three and four, and you need to be able to, you know, be a lot more flexible with where you hit your boundaries, unless you're hitting them over everyone's head. But yeah, like I think it's shocking to a lot of people who probably have only watched modern cricket to be like, wait, he played limited overs cricket for Australia? Because he doesn't look like that kind of guy at all. But again, I think it goes back to what we're saying before, that sort of the smarts and the technical ability he had of like, no, I can make this work. He was never going to be a plus white ball player, I don't think, over a long period of time. He was always going to make runs, but he was probably going to be a little bit too slow. But he was certainly someone who was fine as a fringe player coming in. Like, I don't think anyone had any issues with him being in the side, but I don't think he was ever going to have a major career in it.
He had this weird thing where there were like a couple of bursts in T20 cricket, which made everyone scratch their heads. I know there was one Big Bash season, which you spoke of. Once he came over to the PSL and did quite well, that's where we got Science is the Man. So that's another major Osman Khwaja contribution, by the way, that no one will ever talk about. All the podcasts will miss it, but we won't forget to mention it. But yeah, I was looking at his record and you're looking at 39 innings in ODI cricket, 1554 runs, an average of 42, strike rate of 84. So yeah, maybe those would be good numbers in the early 2000s. But in this era, he was never going to quite cut it. But then again, he had a bit of a spell. And, you know, some people will remember, especially people who watched that series win for Australia and India.
He could certainly make a lot of runs. Like, an average of 42 is a very good average, right? It was just that he, you know, didn't have the dynamism to really help that team.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, then. On to Osman Khwaja, the personality. I mentioned at the start of the podcast that he may not go out as an out-and-out legend, right? Or great of the game in that sense. But when it comes to important cricketers from Australia, he is extremely important. He was the first Muslim cricketer to don the baggy green for Australia, represent them in Test cricket, who was also South Asian as well. So there are two things that you don't see very frequently. And he kind of becomes the face of New Australia, the diverse melting pot captained by Pat Cummins, the woke prince who was promised, right? Like, there's a shift. And Osman Khwaja was quite vocal about how throughout his journey, he had to go through a lot of setbacks where he felt that he was being dealt with unfairly. There are very strong sentiments in there. And he's always been someone who isn't afraid to voice his opinions and sentiments as well. But what I kind of admire about Uzi, and this is kind of personal for me, you have to understand this, because I was a Pakistani who then went to another country and got naturalized and became a citizen. So I'm Canadian-Pakistani now, and I'm very proud of my Canadian link as well. I feel like my formative years were spent in that country. So a lot of my values come from, you know, Canada, for instance. And I see that in Osman Khwaja. I know that he goes out of his way to stamp his identity because he has had a fascinating journey. But let's not forget that this guy is extremely proud to be Australian, and he never fails to mention that either. And people come out and say that, oh, he should be grateful, this, that, the other. He's always been grateful. He's kind of really shown that to the world, that playing for Australia at Test level means a lot to him. I mean, it's weird how whenever Osman Khwaja says something like this and you say something nice about him on social media, the bigots come out in their numbers.
Yeah, I think that's always going to happen. I think I'm trying to remember when he made his debut. I think it was
2011.
So he made his debut in 2011. I'm just trying to find this tweet, which was by Rodney Hogg. So Rodney Hogg's an Australian bowler. And he sent out a tweet. I want to say it was for Australia Day. I can only find the dodgiest New Zealand website with a million pop-ups coming out. Yeah, so in 2012. So Osman Khwaja has played for Australia at this point, right? And Rodney Hogg comes out and he says, just put out my Aussie flag for Australia Day, but I wasn't sure if it would offend Muslims. So I wrote Allah is shit on it to make sure.
Okay.
Now, that is something that is happening during Osman Khwaja's career. And a lot of people this week are really upset because he said that there might be some racial treatment of him due to him playing golf. I think I don't know why people worry. He got into playing golf. He could have got injured coming out of bed or putting his trousers on the wrong way or, you know.
Or getting piss-ass drunk like Ben Duckett and falling off the stairs right. or something like that.
So, right, like, so I fundamentally don't think, I'm not that worried about that. So on both sides. But what I'm saying is when Usman Khawaja just says something like that, he lived in a society that also had Rodney Hogg, a former test player who still goes to events and cricket events and is still part of cricket culture, saying that, right? Like you have to understand where Usman Khawaja came from. My cricket club that was incredibly diverse for the juniors, but the seniors was very, very, you know, white Australia. And our cricket club, where you got changed, was the bar. For a young Muslim kid, and we had lots of young Muslim kids who played before us, they'd never been in a bar before, right? They weren't, it wasn't part of their culture. They weren't, and they were really put off by the fact that they could see the beer and the whiskey and everything there because it made them feel uncomfortable. That is where Usman Khawaja came from. A cricket, you know, Australian cricket culture is intertwined with drinking. As you know, we've got a piece coming out about David Boone's drinking record very soon. They are completely intertwined. And so at every level, he's had that. And then, as you said, you say something positive online and you get bigots come out and still have a go at him, right? Now, the thing with Usman Khawaja is that he is someone who was, I think at times, didn't want to really talk about his background and everything. I don't want to say that. He didn't want to be an other. But the truth is, and you know this being a Pakistani in Canada, I know this being an Australian in England, there is an othering that is just automatic.
Yeah.
Right. And you can try and bury your head and ignore it and everything else. But at a certain level, we've had a lot of people talking about Jofra Archer's chains recently. True. Right. Like there's a lot of othering that still happens. And a lot of the people who are very angry, I'm not going to go into all the individuals who've said this, but a lot of people who are very angry are people who come from the majority. Right. And who don't understand what it is like to be the minority. And he has been the minority for a really long time. And once you're othered consistently, whether you're right or wrong, you see the world as an other person, right? Yeah. And I think that is what we have seen from Usman Khawaja. And most of the people who've abused him are like one-tenth as intelligent as him. He was what, a pilot before he had a driver's license or something stupid like that? The dude's legitimately, and I haven't had a lot to do with him, but we have a lot of friends in common. He is one of the smarter cricketers out there, right? Like you hear him talk on issues. Even if you disagree with him, you're like, this man has thought about this. He has talked through it. He has come to this position, right? And the people who are having a go at him are like, I haven't thought that way, right? And they don't think about things that way. So I just think it's all a little bit silly. But yeah, I think he's had a career and a life of being that sort of other person. And anyone who's been an immigrant or, you know, whether it be skin color, race, ethnicity, you know, moving to another country, sexuality, whatever. Once you get othered enough, it does actually start to, you know, permeate into you. And he is a person who is smart enough to notice all that, right? And a lot of the people who are abusing him are not smart enough to notice all that. And then on top of that, they haven't lived those lives, so they don't get it.
Yeah. Just on the pilot thing, I know that Sikandar Raza will be extremely jealous of Usman Khawaja because that was his dream and Khawaja actually is a licensed pilot. But look, how I viewed his presser was him just recounting his experiences. And he talks about how initially when he comes into the Australian team, because he was a young immigrant kid whose family was struggling. And, you know, in living in that two-bedroom apartment, he dreamt of playing test cricket for Australia. So he tried to fit in and do all of those things that the other blokes were doing. And then he makes the move to Queensland. And there he just makes it a conscious effort or makes a point out of the fact that I'm going to be myself. And that's kind of why I really respect him, because he's always been, or ever since that point on, he's been unapologetically himself. He's been extremely proud of his roots and values, and he's not imposing them on anyone. He's just telling you that he himself is quite proud. He's owned his space, essentially, and he's never shied away from speaking his mind, breaking down barriers and you know, stereotypes. And guys like me get inspired by that, and I'm sure tons of other people would get inspired by that, because he said himself that he wants to pave the way or make the path for the next Usman Khawaja easier, and I can completely get that.
He also, he said something really interesting. He said, I'm the person trying to bring everyone together. Why am I the one who is being abused? And that's right. Like the people who are, you know, specifically the, you know, certain political sort of actors, whatever you want to call them, they're the ones who are trying to divide Australia as a country, right?
Yeah.
Usman Khawaja has never tried to divide Australia as a country. Like, go back in everything he's ever said, right? He's never tried to divide the country at all. And it's funny that it's those people that end up being the ones that are abused. But he's going to be remembered quite well for history. Mm. And, you know, obviously the, you know, Rodney Hoggs and those sorts of people are not. Right. And when it comes down to it, Usman Khawaja is a very important person to Australian cricket culture, but that's not his fault. He's just a cricketer. Right. And you know, it's the Basil de Oliveira thing. And I think Usman Khawaja did try and do the Basil de Oliveira thing for a while of like, no, I just play cricket. But eventually he's too smart and he can't help but notice everything. And as you said, once he becomes himself, it sort of comes out of him naturally.
Yeah. And I mean, look, I kind of admire the quality that, you know, in an age of endorsements and how you could potentially lose them, he hasn't been afraid to champion certain causes. I don't think he makes a political statement when he speaks up for the children of Gaza, for instance. So other people will think that he does make a political statement.
I agree.
Either way, if he's saying don't kill children, why are we making that big a deal out of it, right?
I mean, that at a certain point, anyone who's making that a political issue is maybe not listening to what people are saying there.
Yeah.
Right. And again, that also comes from, this is a very politically minded Australian cricket side, right? You know, there have been a lot of players who really think about these issues in a way that we haven't seen beforehand. And it's one of the reasons that, you know, Justin Langer and Usman Khawaja have this fascinating history, right? I'd love for Justin Langer to do like a 4-hour podcast with Usman Khawaja, like hopefully with a really good host who can really get them in the right area.
Say that, but definitely. He has to be the host.
Justin, don't you agree that science is the man? But but I do think that they are the yin and yang of Australian cricket, right? And you know, if you go back, we have always had, you know, Richie Beno and John Inverarity and these sort of like, you know, statesmanly, like really intelligent Australian voices, and they've been shouted down by the JLs of the world, right? Hmm. This is the first generation where this team is like, no, right? We don't have to be the big angry assholes. We can just be better than other people, right? We can just plan and we can do things correctly. And we also care about the environment and we care about gay rights and we care about Palestinian children. And we're going to say all those things. And we're going to say that we're uncomfortable with some sponsors because we're uncomfortable with some sponsors, right? Yeah.
Also, I mean, it's not like he doesn't speak about other things that happen. We've seen some religious intolerance all across the board, and Usman Khawaja has been front and center talking about those things. Obviously, he's going to talk about Islamophobia a bit more because he's experienced it firsthand. So yeah. I don't know if you've read the Bharat Sundar recent piece or not, but I loved it. And he kind of speaks from the heart because Bharat is someone who's also from South Asia. He makes the move to Australia and he also has experienced the othering. And he speaks about that, how Usman Khawaja kind of saves him from certain situations and kind of backs him up. And, you know, rather than treating him with empathy, I feel like people kind of just started throwing mud on him that, oh, he's playing the race card again. Look, he's had a certain life. He's lived certain experiences and he's coming out there and talking about them because he wants future generation Australian kids to be inspired and not be afraid to pick up that role, right? Or have that dream. So I think that maybe, you know, he rubs people off the wrong way, but what he's trying to do is kind of like a massive service to all of those people who are also marginalized. And I can tell you from experience that that's not a fun place to be, Jared. I've been in airports freaking out after having done nothing wrong, right? So there is that reality and no one likes to talk about it.
And you know what that is like and he knows what that is like and the people saying he's playing the race card do not know what that's like.
Yeah.
Right? They don't understand that. Mm. And unless you've been, you know, as a white, straight, middle-aged man, I've been lucky enough to be othered in so many different ways throughout my life that I get it. I know what it is like to be picked on by the police when you're just walking down the street thinking you're dressed normally and you're being told that you're dressed like a criminal. You know, I've been arrested for hanging around places before and, you know, and as an Australian, every fifth conversation I have in the UK ends with, oh yeah, but you just think that because you're an Aussie, right? Like I'm used to that, right? So I've been lucky to have lived that life and, and also through my wife and my children and people I grew up with as well, right? You know, I grew up with a lot of people who weren't white. So I'm lucky. Not everyone has that background, right? And has that reality. And so what I don't understand is why he's not allowed to talk about it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I think we've got this thing somehow along the line, we decided that you weren't allowed to talk about it. You know, everyone else is allowed to talk about their life when it's positive, right? But when it's negative, you're not allowed to talk about it. And I'm like, if you read most cricket biographies, they are so negative all the way through because it is the player trying to correct the narratives around them. That's what I don't mean this in a negative way about Usman Khawaja because I don't think he said it in a negative way, but that's essentially what Usman Khawaja was doing in that press conference. He was like, this is my lived in experience and I want to tell you guys what it is and I want to tell you how I feel. And then people said, you're wrong for how you feel. It's like,
yeah,
how can that be? He can have wrong political opinions. He can say the wrong things. He can even be wrong about the golf thing, right?
Yeah, true.
But that isn't, but he's not wrong about how he feels because that is how he fucking feels, right? Yeah. And that's the bit that I think that, you know, as you know, sport has been so dominated by uncle culture, right?
Yeah.
Of like these sort of repressed middle-aged men going, no, it's, you know, don't rub it if it hurts. What the fuck are you talking about? If I rub it, I might be able to loosen the muscle for a minute, right? And fix it so I can go on and bat further. Like there's so much repressiveness around sport. And I think we're seeing the first generation of people because of social media and because of the kind of world that they're in, just be like, no, I feel this way. And they're not just doing it, right? From a progressive point of view, we're seeing people do it also from a conservative point of view as well. Athletes are more comfortable now in speaking about who they are and where they fit into the world, as they fucking should be, because we treat them like pieces of meat. They're allowed to go, do you know what? It's very uncomfortable to be treated like a piece of meat. Go and have a look at Robbie talking about the auction, right? Robbie made a fuck ton of money from the auction, right?
Yeah.
But look at how he talks about it. He felt uncomfortable being treated like a piece of meat. And people are like, I can't believe you said that. You were overpaid or whatever. And it's like, fuck off. You don't understand what he's saying, right?
Yeah, and I mean,
that's what we're talking about here.
I think like, you know, anyone's feelings should be valid. You shouldn't invalidate those. But also, what is up with this notion that, oh, Australia gave you a life and a great career and you have a $4 million beach home? What does that have to do with anything? Should he always remain grateful and not talk about his experiences? That's utter crap, bullshit, rubbish. And I just
Well, that's something that no one would ever say, right? About a kid who grew up in Australia, whose family was born in Australia, right?
Yep.
I owe just as much to Australia as Usman Khawaja does. I've never seen anyone say that about me.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I mean, I wouldn't be, you know, I'm such a weird mix of things, but a lot of it comes from the family environment I had, the friends that I had, northern suburbs of Melbourne, Melbourne as a whole, right? You know, Australia as an influence there. Do I have to fucking thank Australia if, you know, Combox becomes really successful? I don't understand it. But again, that's the othering. You have to be thankful because we gave you this. Those people didn't give him that because they're the people still moaning that he exists in the first place.
Yeah, it's his hard work. And honestly, like, if I think about it, of course, I'm grateful to Canada for the experience, for the broadening of horizons. But does that mean I can't be critical of Canada? Fuck no.
Yeah.
Of course I can be. If anything, and I think that right because I'm a citizen, right?
Yeah. And I think that's a big one. I've always said, you know, my parents are over here at the moment and I love my parents. But if you want to have a proper conversation, and you and I have done this on this show at times as well, about I've talked about things that went on in my childhood where my parents just got it wrong, right? That's not like my parents are evil and I hate them because they're in my house right now looking after my kids, right? Like I love them. I have a great relationship with them. But if I can be critical of how my parents brought me up, I can be critical of my nation.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
And I should be. And not only that, I can be critical of the nation I live in now. There are many things I love about London, right? And there are many things I don't like about the UK in general. Like both of these things are true at the same time. And this idea that you need to be grateful as an immigrant has to fuck off and die, right? Yeah. Because Usman Khawaja has given back more to his country by what he's done than most people who have been born in that country. Like he's already done it. He put on the fucking cap. He faced bounces being, you know, being put at him, right? You know, he's already done that in a way that other people don't. So I think people just need to, but as I said before, this all comes back to that basic thing that people don't really understand it because their experience does not match his experience. And that's the issue is we can't make people, you know, understand that. And it's why, you know, this whole generation of people who don't like empathy, it's because they don't want to do the work.
Yeah.
Right? Absolutely. Empathy is work to understand what that person has gone through.
True. And, you know, it's interesting that I feel that Khawaja would have been a bit of a polarizing figure, even if he was white, because he's a vocal guy. You've probably watched The Test, right? Like the documentary on Amazon. that point where he's the spokesperson for the team that talks to JL and says that guys are getting a bit uncomfortable, they're a bit scared of you. No one had the guts to do that, and Khwaja exactly. does that. And he doesn't hate JL. He actually has an interesting relationship with JL. He's credited him for, you know, backing him in spinning conditions. So it's not like those two were at odds, but he was the guy who became the player's spokesperson. And I find that very, very fascinating.
Exactly. And I think ultimately, I hope that, I mean, obviously, you know, the immigration thing and racial thing and religious thing, I think all those things are really, really important.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I just think Australian cricket will be better if there are more people like Usman Khawaja willing to go, JL, you're talking shit.
Hmm.
Right?
True.
And I know that there was a player who's not, I don't know if this is publicly available, so I won't say who the player is, but I know a player tried that with Darren Lehman and found it very, very hard. It's hard to speak up to those guys. You know, I don't know if I've ever told my Darren Lehman story before, but I asked Darren Lehman a very, very generic question about wicketkeeping once because they'd made a selection decision. And he was so like physical and in my face in that moment, right? And I was just like, wait, what? And I'd forgotten that I'd gone back into Australian cricket. I'd traveled around the world talking to so many different people. I forgot I'd gone back. Now, Darren Lehman's also a genius. Justin Langer also has elements of genius in him as well. But they're so used to yelling and getting their way and being the big men. You need someone like Usman Khawaja to be like, just pop the bubble, right? Yeah. And this Australian team, through guys like Cummins and Khawaja, you know, and a lot of them have managed to pop that bubble and just be like, we can be hard and we can be Australian and we can play cricket in an Australian style, but we can also be smart. Can't we be smarter than other teams? And yeah, Usman Khawaja, ultimately, for all the different things, I think that's the one that I think is the most interesting from a cricket legacy point of view, because that argument was always lost within Australian cricket. And I feel now it's never been stronger that we don't just have to go harder, right? Yeah. Sometimes True. We could just be smarter.
I'm surprised that Darren Lehman didn't sand your papers. But anyway, I feel like he's also a bit of a leader in that dressing room and he warrants a certain amount of respect, because here's an interesting like kind of, you know, comparison. Owen Morgan wins the ODI World Cup. They celebrate with Moeen Ali and Adil Rashid. And then later on, they pop the champagne bottles. Pat Cummins wins the World Test Championship with Usman Khawaja. They don't pop the champagne bottle. And that for me was like a big first. And yeah. I don't know how to kind of put this, because I mean, if it were up to me, I would be dancing in the champagne, right? Like I'm a different person altogether. But
the point
is that they made that choice. And I feel like that goes on to speak volumes of the way this sort of Australian unit that we've seen under Pat Cummins has been very inclusive. And honestly, in this world where there's so much polarization, extreme polarization and exclusivity, anyone who advocates for inclusivity is a hero. So for me, Uzi is a hero and he is one of the most important cricketers from Australia. And I would want him to not be afraid championing his causes even in the future, because you never know. He could have a career in media. He could be a goddamn politician. We don't know where this is headed.
It's actually really fascinating to see what he does next. I'm with you. Yeah. I think he's a natural podcaster. You know, Combox might have to give him a call, but, you know, he's a natural podcaster, but, you know, he might want to do more than that. But I do feel like he's someone who likes talking cricket, but I also think he's someone who likes talking about other things. So it will be fascinating to see where he is. But he's a very important person in modern Australian culture, right?
Hmm.
You know, with what's happened in the last couple of weeks in Australia again,
yeah.
You know, with all sorts of things that happened during his career, you know, the Cronulla riots and all these different things that have happened. Not to mention, you know, the Australian guy that went over to New Zealand and shot everyone up, right? Like all these different things have happened involving Australia over his career. And I feel like, I said this before, but when I read Ricky Ponting's book, it felt like someone who hadn't actually noticed anything that went on in the world. And I think he didn't have to notice anything that went on in the world, because all he had to do was worry about cricket. Because of the othering, Usman Khawaja has had to notice everything that has gone on in the world.
Yeah.
And that makes him a much more interesting person when it comes to those sorts of things. Doesn't make him a better cricketer. It doesn't make him, you know, a legend of the game, but it makes him a much more interesting person. And I think that if nothing else, that's what Usman Khawaja's legacy might be. You know, is the adult in the room who's willing to speak up and say what he actually felt.
Yeah. And I mean, I found it quite fitting that A, he started his career versus England in Sydney and he's ending it the same way. And it was kind of iconic and also fitting that he has an embrace sort of moment with the hero of Bondi Beach. And I thought that's just like, you know, something that was written in the stars, honestly, very, very fitting. That's what a farewell should be like. It kind of all comes together. And his performance in the Sydney Test doesn't matter. That doesn't speak anything with respect to his legacy. Everything that we've discussed in this podcast does. And Uzi, just as we end this, if you're watching, go well in retirement.
He's not
luck from us. He's probably not watching. But yeah, I mean, look, if you did by any chance watch this and you're interested to work with us, reach out. We'd love to work with you as well.
And we might send him a direct message rather than this public one. But look, I think he's been a fascinating cricketer to cover all the way through, and I'm wishing him best and whatever happens next.
Yep. All the best from the Good Areas and Combox team, Uzi. And we hope that by the time this podcast comes out, you've scored a ton in your final test match, because that's what Paddy Cummins said. One more 100 to go. He's averaging like 87.5 with the bat in Sydney. So that might happen. But anyway, that's a wrap on our tribute podcast for Usman Khawaja. If you liked this video, please do like, share and subscribe. Tell your friends about Combox as well. And we'll see you soon enough on another show. That is all for today. Have a good one, folks. And goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.